Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Frank Colson, internationally known sculptor, potter, author, performer, musician, futurist, raconteur, Renaissance man. He's amazing. Hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
About recognizing that unfortunately many of our childhoods contain experiences that have forced us to pretend to be other than we are. It can happen in the family of origin when somebody, a parent or a sibling or an aunt or a grandparent, lets us know in no uncertain terms that something about us is not attractive, something about us is something that we should be embarrassed about, or that we should try not to be. This can happen also as a result of an experience we have in school. Perhaps we are different from a lot of the other kids. Perhaps most of the kids have light-colored eyes or light hair, and we have jet-black something. Or maybe we're tall, and everybody else is sort of regular size, or the other way around. Everybody is regular size or tall, and we're short. These things actually are not that important, but they can be the cause of our feeling that there's something wrong with us. And when we feel that, we try desperately to pretend that it's not true. We are not different from, we are not unattractive. We are not that thing that we would be embarrassed about if we could accept that we were. So we come into adulthood demonstrating a version of ourselves that is not the complete truth, because not only did we pretend not to be something, but we forgot we were. So the Lynn Show is about saying, if this happened to you, if you recognize this, it may not be too late to recover whatever it is that you felt you had to leave behind. And if you are interested in getting some help with that, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E, L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com, where if you want to ask me any questions, you can click on the button that says email me and ask me any questions or make any comment that you'd like to make. You can get access to my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization, or you can listen to all of the shows I've ever done, all of the interviews, including the one I'm about to do with Frank Colson, who is exactly what he is in every conceivable way. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you hear them speak, you can hear what it sounds like to be your real self, and Frank Colson is that in spades. So now, here, the extraordinary Frank Colson. Okay, so I'm here with Frank Colson in his amazing house, like being in the forest.
Yes.
Yes, it's lovely.
Yeah, I designed it that way. I had installed those faces around the side. The size of the room was predicted by how many of those clay faces I put in here.
So I should explain that going around the periphery of the room are clay faces, which I'm assuming you created. Yes, and the room size was dictated by how many of those clay faces you can... My God, how many of them are there?
Oh, let's make a count. I don't know. I don't remember. I put them up so long because there were X number of faces, and they were what predicted the size of this room.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And
so rather than the other way around.
Around.
You know, oh, what should we do with these?
All right. Oh, I know. Yeah, we'll make them make a room.
Right.
That's great. And so they're looking down on us.
I suppose.
Yes, yes. Okay, so I interview people who make a living or a life with an art. And from what you tell me, see, I only knew of you as a sculptor, but as you tell me, there are other arts to which you have given your life.
Oh, yes,
yeah?
Indeed.
So I only ask one question. Can you tell me the very first moment in your life when you found yourself drawn to a particular art when you were very young?
Yes, indeed, I can. And it occurred in the following fashion. In grade school, I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles. In grade school, I had a friend, you know, like kids do, a buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy's mother worked for Walt Disney.
Uh-huh.
She was the only employee Walt Disney had. So
you're kidding.
Yeah, and I was like 5 years old.
Wow.
So we decided, myself initially, decided we should form a club. Basically, it was a Mickey Mouse club. So we would meet in this little add-on room in the back of the garage, which was called the clubhouse. And there were maybe six of us kids, you know, aging from 6 to 12 or something. And all we did was just take funny books and draw, hand-draw Mickey Mouses.
You mean copy them?
Well, copy, not in the sense that we think of today, but yes, we would draw the Mickey Mouse
mm-hmm.
characters from the funny books.
Wow. Every day you drew the same one?
Not the same one,
yes,
but every day we drew Mickey Mouse.
Wow!
So anyway, that was my beginnings in
mm-hmm.
art. So that's sort of where I got started. And then, of course, from there, everything came about in its natural progression.
Well, what was its natural... I mean, did you say to your parents, I like to draw? Or did they notice? Or did anybody? Did you take lessons? Did they... No, you're shaking your head.
None of the above. No.
None of the above?
No, yeah, because my parents were not into the arts. They were not artists.
So then how did it progress? If they didn't recognize it or help you, or how did you go from Mickey Mouse to...
I was always drawing, and in grade school, I was elected art historian.
Mm-hmm.
So that pretty well covers my training in the art world.
So at this point in your, you know, schooling, are you thinking I'm going to be an artist? Are you thinking what you're going to do? No.
No, I was thinking much more in terms of I've got the biggest ego than anyone else. And I'm going to use this ego because I love being, being seen in action.
Recognized.
Exactly. I didn't stick to just doing fine art.
Ah.
I then became an animator physically. I knew that all I had to do is go out to the beach as a 13-year-old, stand up on a bench, and start moving, speaking.
Really?
Yeah.
And then people would come around and listen or watch or?
We'd gather a crowd that way.
So are you thinking then that I'm going to use this skill that I have to get attention, that that's somehow how I'm going to live my life? You're not thinking that either.
No, no, no. Quite the contrary, because throughout my career, I didn't worry about being recognized. I knew I would be recognized because my ego was bigger than any kid of that age would even consider.
So what were you thinking about doing? Or weren't you thinking about it? You were just sort of putting one foot in front of the other.
And doing it.
Yeah, and doing it.
And
exactly.
Just doing it. For example, the way the transition that I made as a kid at that age was they had a big, huge old radio in the living room of my home, and I would listen to all the radio dramas. And I found myself mimicking some of the radio drama programs, like Dick Tracy or the Batman. And, you know, whenever there was a scream or a holler from part of the drama, you know,
yes.
I would mimic it. And I was a member of the Sheriff Boys Band, the Los Angeles Sheriff Boys Band.
Wow.
And we would, the band, which was, you know, a group of young kids who played instruments, we would march into Pershing Square playing, you know, our favorite numbers, like da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da. Hardly our favorite, but they did. Then at the end of the square was a stage where they had professional entertainers, like Spike Jones.
Oh, my.
So I ended up sitting on a chair behind Spike Jones' band. And when Spike Jones would get up and start to narrate one of his songs, like, what was it, The Races or something, and there goes car number three, there goes four, there goes, oh, watch out for the turn. You know? So here I'm watching all of this as a kid sitting on the same stage with Spike Jones.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. I took that material out to the beach with me and stood up on the bench and said, okay, everybody, now watch out. Here's the latest thing on the races in town. So that's how I introduced myself to the public.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because, as I said, my ego was big.
Well, did you have the word ego then, or did you just know? You didn't. No, of course not. You just knew that you were someone that people wanted to watch.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay, and so then you just kept finding things to offer them, essentially.
Yes, yes. Maybe I wouldn't use the word finding, but they would just fall in my lap, like the
yes.
radio series and so on. Batman.
Yeah, right. Well, you were observant. I mean, there were lots of things going on in the world, and you saw them and used them.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so we still haven't gotten you out of high school, and already you're talking about several arts, several ways of performing, of creating, right?
Correct,
okay,
yes.
And, yeah. And you're not thinking past this minute. This minute I'm standing up here doing this, and these people seem to like it, and that's all.
Yeah, that's the way my life evolved, because in the theater arts, which I became very involved in.
Oh, I want to hear that.
That transition took place in high school because in high school in Los Angeles, you're required to take one course called English, you know. Not this high school. You had two choices as a kid. You could take English as a required course, or if you didn't want to, instead you could take Shakespeare.
Oh, my gosh.
So here's my next transition. So for 4 years in high school, I only took Shakespeare.
Oh, my goodness.
And I never did take English.
Well, see, clearly your English is fine, so you didn't suffer. What? And anyway, if you... Oh, my gosh. You had 4 years of Shakespeare High School. That's very amazing.
Absolutely. So I ended up, you know, playing in... my first role was King Lear, and, you know, as a 18, 19-year-old. And I was playing Shakespeare roles all over Los Angeles in the Shakespeare festivals.
Okay, now this is all in high school.
High school age.
High school age.
Yeah.
Amazing. And you're still not thinking what you're going to do when you grow up.
Oh, no, because I'm already
You're doing it.
There.
That's right. You're already there. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, so you graduate from high school, and then what do you do?
Yes, I do graduate. Actually, well, this is a incidental part of my life, which incidental, but still played a big part, and that is I then went to college.
Mm-hmm. Did you major in something?
Yes, I was an art major.
You were an art major. Now, that's interesting. Not a drama major.
No.
You're doing all this performing, but you're not majoring in theater. You're majoring in art.
Exactly.
And any particular form of art?
Well, the normal curriculum that the college would offer,
mm-hmm.
you know, like some classes were art history,
mm-hmm.
and others were, you know, I had a really tough time because the college that I took 98% of my art classes from was an all-women's college. And it was across the street where I was enrolled in an all-men's college.
Oh.
So... Well, Mr. Colson, if you're majoring in art, there's only one place for you to take classes, across the street at the Women's College. So here I am, a 20-year-old kid, you know, bursting to let everyone know how talented
yes,
I am.
Yes, here I am, yeah. Right? Yes.
So I go into the drawing classes, but naturally in that college was filled with girl students.
Right.
And I'm nude model.
Yes, right.
Gee, so I had to keep my eyes riveted on the model and or, you know, the girls around there. So anyway, it became my academic source, but I still kept my entertainment going. During college events, that all colleges have for their students, I would do a skit of some sort during intermission when the orchestra stopped and people stopped dancing, and I at that point met my wife Diana, and
in college you met Diana?
Yes, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, she wasn't involved in the drawing section at all. She was in the chorus.
Huh.
And I went to the college chorus to hear one of their events, and noticed this woman, this girl with long black hair that riveted my eyes. So the long and short was, we started dating. First date we have, we go to a college event, which was, you know, dancing and stuff like that. And in the premise of that area, there was, you know, a make-believe marriage booth. So Diana and I got married on our first time.
And the rest is history, right? Yeah, really? Oh, my God.
You got it.
Wow.
You got it.
So, okay. So,
how long do we want to go on this interview?
Wow. That's great. That's really great. Okay, so, all right, so you're in college, you're studying art, but you're still doing performing, and you're still not thinking, what am I going to do when I get out of here? Because you're so busy thinking, well, I'm doing this. Oh, did you do any Shakespeare in college?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. All the major Shakespeare festivals.
Right.
And so on.
Yeah. Okay, so now you graduate from college. Were you married by then, or?
Well, I didn't quite get out of college. Yes, I did get a degree, but Uncle Sam called me.
Oh, dear.
And this in itself is an interesting story, because Uncle Sam said, And I was not, hadn't finished my degree in college yet.
Wow.
I was only one semester away, and I was caught in between those months that young men are taken by draft, or if they're in school, they're not taken by draft. And so I was taken, drafted by the U.S. Army, and my only hope to get into something in the military, although I was trying to avoid the military every cross possible, but my only hope was playing an instrument that maybe I could get
in the band.
In the band.
You're right.
So I'm standing in line as the military are checking young recruities in, and I'm hearing them next to me on both sides. All right, SS artillery. Okay, you know, these troops. And they come to me, U.S. Army band.
Yay!
So I get put into the U.S. Army band, and the long and the short of that is I spent most of my military time playing reveille for the troops. Had to get up in the morning, you know, before all the other people
were up,
go out in the icy cold because I was living in Paradise, Alaska.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we'd go out, the band would go out and play reveille to wake up
everybody,
the troops.
Right.
And then go back to bed. Well, we didn't. We had to taskmaster in the building we were in, and once we came back from playing reveille, he put us to work rehearsing on orchestrations like A Night on Bald Mountain.
Oh my gosh!
I mean, this was serious.
Serious business, right? Okay, so how long were you in the Army?
Less than 2 years, and that became a coup.
It's already a coup. You were in the band, right? So what is this coup?
Well, this coup was that I was always looking for a better situation than the one I felt I'd been caught in. And so I was in the U.S. Army band, and I was living on base in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Yes.
Okay. So I was still looking for other opportunities, and I found that there was a local television station in Fairbanks that needed somebody to close the station for the night with nightly news and so forth and so on.
Perfect for you.
Yes. And by the way, the reason I got that position in Fairbanks was because I had maneuvered myself in the military to being a disc jockey.
Right,
that was before I got the job in town.
Right.
So I was a disc jockey, and I grew up, which is another story, I grew up with jazz, you know, all my life in my youth, like climbing on the back wall of the Hollywood Bowl and watching Stan Kenton and stuff like that. So my whole background was in jazz. And as a disc jockey, that's all I played was jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And somebody in the local community would call and say, "Hey, why don't you play Hank Williams?" And I said, "Who the hell is Hank Williams?"
I'm playing Dizzy, right?
Exactly.
Right.
So anyway, this is going on pretty well when the Army offered a talent competition.
Oh.
And you know, a little...
Yes, right.
Wee ego me.
Yes, right. Then, yes, sir. Right.
So anyway, it was a army-wide, entire army for the whole country, It was a talent competition.
What did you do?
I won it.
Of course you won it.
I entered in the comedy division and won it.
Oh, my God.
So immediately, the U.S. Army in Fairbanks cut orders for me. I was put on a plane. Wow. Flown to New York City. First time in my life.
My God.
First time in my life.
What did you do? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the number I did was Victor Borg's phonetic punctuation. That's the number I won the competition with.
Wow. I don't know. I'm sure I've seen it, but can you do a little?
Oh, I can only do a piece or two.
Yeah.
The phonetic punctuation that Victor Borg did became really acclaimed with it because it was about writing a letter phonetically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I looked through the sky to see the sunset.
I see.
Which indicated that was a semicolon.
Yes, I got it, I got it. So, oh my God, so you learned that and did it.
I had it down so cold, it was, I would say, with my ego at that time, it was better than Victor Borg.
I'll bet it was.
And he was playing the Golden Theater down on Broadway at the time that I did this performance on ABC TV.
Oh, so they sent you to New York to do it on TV?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I did it nationally on ABC TV after the show that evening. And I'm in uniform because I'm not out of the service yet.
Right, right.
I go down to the Golden Theater on Broadway. And because I was so cocky anyway, I would just walk up to the box office, and there was a headliner, Victor Borg,
right.
You know, Golden Theater, and I just said, I want to go in and see Victor Borg. You know, didn't pay anything or anything like
right.
that. It was just very straightforward, and they said, well, you go through that door, and he's, you know, he's in there doing his act.
Yeah.
So I walked in through the door of the theater and watched a portion of his work, which was the ending, and I was going to myself, I can do better.
I can do that, right? I can do better than that. I love it. I love it.
So after his performance, I go downstairs to his dressing room, knock on his door, and Mr. Borg, y'all, come in, you know. And I tell him what I just accomplished
right.
on television,
right.
on national television, because I got a lot of offers after that. And he shook his head and he looked at me and he said, Bill, you need a good work and you had it. Isn't that amazing? Today's day with copyrights and everything.
Right.
I mean,
He just congratulated you, essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
Took it right off.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him. So what do you mean you got offers? What kind of offers did you get?
Oh, you know, from various nightclubs like in Miami and Chicago, places like that, to be a nightclub.
So did you do it?
Entertained. No, because I hadn't finished college. I got drafted one semester before
right.
I finished college. So, you know, I was attuned to these offers, but I had to go back and finish college. And so, you know, so the story of my life goes from that phase into the next.
Because you didn't follow the nightclub career.
Correct.
Okay. So now, when did you and Diana get married? Before you, or after you came out of the service?
Yeah, right after.
Ah. All right. So then you went back to college, and you finished your degree.
Correct.
And then what?
In arts. My degree in fine arts.
Your degree in fine arts.
Right.
Now, at this point, have you chosen an art, a specialty?
I would put it in different words and say, I became the artist.
You became the artist.
At that
yes.
time. Knowing what my endeavors were going to be in the future.
Well, wait a minute. How did you know that?
Because I had a plan.
Ah, that know? Was my question. So what was your plan?
Well, the immediate plan was marital related.
Yes.
Okay. So Diana, who at that time was teaching out at Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, we were, you know, communicating with each other and just saying, yeah, we do want to get married and so on. And look, I'm living in Fairbanks, she's living in Aberdeen, Maryland, you know, and I had this urge to go see Europe. I've never been in Europe, except more than that. And I said, well, when I get out of the service, because I knew at that point I was close to being out, I said, I want to go see Europe, and I want you and me to get married and go to Europe. And there was a little bit of flack about, well, you know, a young college girl, oh, this is coming on a little heavy. You know? So anyway, the quick wrap-up on this part is she came out to California. We both got married on the Scripps Women College campus, where I had first met her. And bingo, we were off to Europe. And that's a whole endeavor in itself, because we lived in Europe for almost 2 years. And really interesting experiences. But they weren't related with the arts or entertainment so much, but they were just exploration.
Yeah, they were just living.
Yeah. I mean, we landed in Zurich, and a college colleague of ours we met in the office insisted we get a job at the business he was at, which was the business of delivering cars to American tourists all over Europe.
Wow.
So Diana and I spent nearly a year, Zurich being our base, mostly Volkswagen Beetles, because Americans were into their first phase, you know, this is, what, late 40s? Well, yeah, early 50s, I guess, yeah. And so Americans were coming into Europe and buying a VW Beetle because that was their second car.
Yes, right.
So both Diane and I were driving these brand new Beetles to Paris and dropping them off there and to Rome and, you know. So we saw Europe well and got paid for it.
It's lovely. Okay, so now, at this point, do you still have your plan? And it's just sort of waiting to take shape, or you haven't created it yet?
Oh, no, I've got more than my plan. I now have a legacy.
Oh. What does that mean?
That means I've been a professional sculptor for 50 years. I'm internationally recognized. I've exhibited in more than 20 countries.
Okay, wait a second. That's where it went. Where did it start? I mean, so you're driving cars all over Europe now. So where...
Well, that terminated after a year and a half. I had to come back and get my college degree finished.
Oh, you still hadn't done that?
No, I hadn't.
Oh, so you came back and got your degree. Did you know at that point that sculpting was where you wanted to go?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in that I was so involved in the art department at Scripps College, and some incredible things happened at that junction for me, dealing with the Japanese culture. That was the trigger that, one, two, three, that had endorsed me ending up in Sarasota, which is a story in itself, and opening the first pottery school in Sarasota.
Wow. And this was in the early 50s? And so then you're working primarily in pottery at that point?
Exclusively. I opened the first pottery school here.
Oh, yeah.
Next door in that building.
Wow.
And we had a waiting list for 30 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And all we did exclusively was throw pots on the wheel. No hand builder.
All right. So...
See that form there?
Yes.
That's a wall fountain.
Wow. Wow.
Thrown off the wheel.
You're kidding.
And... 1 year I made over 500 of those that were sold all over the country.
It's beautiful.
They all were fired and came right out of this property.
So, when did you come here? What year? Do you remember?
Yeah, we came here, I think it was 55 or 6, right about then, because I was looking for a studio.
Well, how did you, I mean, I mean, Sarasota was not on the map then.
No.
No.
Okay, a little side story, how I ended up here, and that is that because of my other endeavors that I've described already, I got a job at Florida State University being a producer director for television. After all, I've been a radio producer and so on.
Right, and you've been a disc jockey.
Yeah, and all of that.
Right.
So we ended up in Tallahassee. It's where we had our second baby. My first one was born in California. And I got a job as a producer director for educational television at Florida State. And I'm the one to press the button to turn that station on the air.
So, this is something of a departure. I mean, you've come out of school with a degree in art. How did you get a job as the producer of a television?
Well, partially, a little gap in the story here, is that I knew when I finished my undergraduate degree that there was one thing I wanted to do, and that was to combine the physical arts, the three-dimensional arts, the performing arts into one thing. And those were the days in the early 50s when television was just coming out of, you know, being black and white.
Yeah.
And anyone and their dog could be on television, you know.
Right.
So I thought, that's the key. So what I want to do is either be a television producer, then I can practice all of the talents that I'm able to do, or we move to Australia.
Yeah.
Because in Australia, television is just in its infancy.
Right.
You know? So we immigrated to Australia.
My God.
For 2 years.
That before or after here?
Before.
Before.
Yeah.
So you cut your teeth essentially in TV in Australia. So you had a resume.
No, because I got my master's degree.
Oh, there.
I went for my master's degree at Syracuse University, where I learned the tools of becoming a television producer.
Oh, very wise.
So I already knew the tools.
Yes.
I said to myself, "You got to know how to do this if that's your route," you know.
Okay, so you get a master's, and now you are really credentialed to do this.
Yeah, I'm professional.
Then you go to then you go to Australia, where I assume you do it.
No.
No, of course not. Silly me.
Well, I would have had television been progressed enough.
Right.
But Australia was the only country, and we've lived in a lot of countries, the only country I've ever lived in that was undeveloped, I would say, underdeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
Socially, politically, everything else. Now, it's the greatest country in the world at that time if you were into, you know, animal husbandry or,
right,
you know, wild kangaroo hunting or some crazy Australian
right,
thing.
Right, right, right.
But I got there and I found out that you know, television and broadcasting, you know, it hadn't even scratched the surface yet.
Wow.
So, what did I do? I set up my own sculpture studio.
Ah!
And ended up doing workshops, symposiums, and lectures all over the country, all expenses paid.
Who was paying for it?
Whatever the institution is.
Oh, yeah, they would call you. They would bring you in, right. Okay, so again, You're just essentially, I'm using the kangaroo image here, but you're just hopping from one art to another, right? Oh, this one, okay, good. No, okay, then I'll do this one,
yep.
Right? Essentially, right. Okay, so then did you...
You could say I was assessing my life at that time.
Yes, you were tasting, essentially.
But not realizing that.
No, because as I see it, what you pretty much have always done is what's in front of you. You know, it's not much about plan. It's much more about, oh, okay, I'll do this. All right, here, this is this, I'll do this.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so the job at Florida State University, did you apply for that, or did somebody...
Well, yes. I just gotten out of graduate school in Syracuse with my advanced degree
mm-hmm.
in communication.
Right.
Is what the degree was, not in TV.
Uh-huh.
And so Diana and I came down to what we said to each other. We said, look, we're both from California, grew up there and so on. We said, hey, let's go down to Florida and then back home to California.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's an opportunity to see part of America that we know we'll never go back to.
Yes, right. Surprise.
right. Yeah.
Right. But again, I mean, it just sort of came up and you said, good, we'll do this for a while, right?
Yeah, but I never said for a while. I would say we're going to do this professionally.
Right.
You know, because... That was the attitude we had when we were delivering automobiles all over Europe,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we wouldn't handle the clients.
No, you're serious.
Oh, yeah.
Right, you're serious and professional no matter what you do.
Yeah, I'm in my mid-20s, you know.
Yes. Okay, so you're doing TV for Florida State University, is that what you said?
Yes.
Right? And how long did that last?
Not too long. Interesting quirks happen there. What I did, as a producer-director, you can really call all the shots when you're doing a program
right.
in television. And so now, I wasn't involved in any way in being a comedian or a performer. I was producing programs.
Right.
And many of the programs were out of classes that were taught on campus, like a science program maybe. But I would get Metropolitan Opera stars coming in from New York just for a weekend performance, and we would do those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we had a really nice range. Unfortunately, from my departure, otherwise I guess I'd still be there, is that I was very, very innovative. And I would do the horrible thing of doing double exposures. Now, mind you, I've got a person in the department head who grew up as an FM radio person, didn't even know how to think visually.
Right.
You know, and I would get my cameraman set up on, you know, might be a dance program from the Met or whatever, and man, I would start with a visual like we're accustomed to today, you know. Boy, did I get called on the carpet on that, you know. Because these people didn't...
They couldn't.
My boss, they couldn't visualize.
They couldn't see it.
Yeah.
Right.
And they kept banging at me with that. And I just got pissed off and I said, I'm leaving. And, you know, it wasn't the end of the semester or anything. I just got up. I said, come on, Diana, we're going. And I'm going to open my own studio, my own sculpture studio.
And so you came down here?
Because the reason, here's how come we ended up in Sarasota, is because the director of the drama department at the university, who I got to know quite well, and he said, you know, we're going to go explore a place in Florida where all they do is perform Shakespeare. And I said, can I join you? Can I check this place out with you? So the first time we ever came to Sarasota, it was because the Oslo Theater was doing a Shakespearean junket.
It was like a Shakespeare festival or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Amazing.
So I came down here, and the Shakespeare was in my blood.
Yes.
And by the way, my English teacher, mother who raised me, was always quoting Shakespeare to me, even before I got to school. And so, you know, the Shakespeare Festival was on here, full time, and I go, wow, this is where we're living. Not that I needed the beaches and all that, because I grew up with beaches
right.
in California, you know.
Right.
And I was a swimmer and all. But that decided it, because of the Oslo Theater and Shakespeare is why we live here.
Well, and of course you couldn't have chosen better. I mean, there's theater all over the place here.
You talk about predicting the future.
Right, exactly.
Wow. I mean, and then I realized, this was about 10 years ago, that I know how to predict the future.
And
for myself.
For yourself, yeah.
And
actually, I think the way you predicted the future, forgive me, you may not agree, is just by putting one foot in front of the other where it felt like it should go.
Right.
You know, and you were just right about it. Your instincts are perfect about it, right? It's great.
Yeah, and I, you know, right this very minute, it's easy to predict the future of Florida, because it's the fastest growing state in the country, and the population growth is coming at such a point that we're going to, by necessity, have to have speed trains in this state, where you're going from Tampa to Jacksonville in 20 minutes.
Yes.
Like we did when we went from Kyoto, Japan to Tokyo in 1 hour at the speed of over 200 miles an hour. And you're looking out the
oh my God.
Window, all you're seeing is a blur.
Yeah, I didn't realize we were the fastest growing city in the
state
in the country. But I sure knew that Sarasota is growing faster than I would like it to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't deny that.
No.
But it's not going to be like that very long.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it might be the fastest growing state, but the changes that are going to take place are going to be about as radical as, you know, getting on your cell phone.
Give me, what are you thinking of?
Well, 3 to 10 years.
But changes other than the speed trains, or?
Yes. Any kind. In fact, I told my younger son who lives in Venice, I said, you know, try to get some information down, and in a patent form for the following, you know, speed trains, and I mentioned a bunch of other things.
That are coming.
That are coming, that are yet to arrive.
Wow. Well, I can't wait. Well, I will wait. I'm already bothered by the traffic, so I don't, you know.
Aren't we all?
Yes, really. Yeah. Okay, so I have, So then you came here, you opened the pottery studio, and from then on, you simply created art. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
But in doing it, I kept that connection. This is part of my current legacy. I kept that international connection.
Yes, because you have so many connections internationally. Right.
And I published a book in the 70s that carried me to all expenses, in most cases, carried me to well over 20 countries where I was paid all expenses. One of the most interesting one was free for Diane and I, all expenses to New Zealand for 6 weeks.
Wow.
Based on this book I published in the 70s.
And the book was?
Well, I'm going to give you the title. It's very, very romantic.
Yeah.
So this is the title of the book. Kiln Building with Space Age Materials. Now, isn't that exciting?
Apparently it is to a lot of people.
Damn right. The book was published in New York. It was sold on 3 continents, and there was just no end to the accolades I got.
So you're just ahead of your time all over the place, right? Yeah, I love it. I know that we're talking about you as an artist, but you're a futurist, aren't you?
I like that term.
Yeah, and I think it's true of you.
I like that term.
Okay, so the other question that I ask is, having given your life to the exploration of every art you came in contact with, would you say anything about what that is like?
Define what do you mean by what it's like?
How did I react? What you think about it, how you feel about it, anything that comes to mind.
Well, look, when I'm fighting a 500,000-acre forest fire in Alaska, which is one of the things I did, you know, and I'm wearing a flamethrower on my back, and I'm lighting entire mountains on fire because it's called a backfire. You've got one mountain and the flames are coming out here and come down here, you light this other mountain. You know, that's only another part of my life.
Yes.
You know, and we came back from Europe after living there. We had $25 left and a pregnant mother. So she's dropped off in Chicago to stay with an uncle, and I said, there's only one place for me to go, Fairbanks, Alaska. Because there, you could get a job, be sent out in the boonies, not even see civilization for a month, and you'd come back with a paycheck bigger than you could ever believe, because not getting a lot per hour, maybe $1.45, but there were endless hours I get paid. $7.24, you know.
So you did everything that needed to be done while you were doing everything you wanted to do.
Good way of putting it. Good way of putting it.
And. Okay, then I think that's probably a good place to stop.
Well, the only bummer is that, you know, now that I had a stroke, it's really slowed me down. You know, and I keep thinking in my head, well, this will all be over with. Yeah, and the doctors say, oh, yeah, no problem in a year from now. You know, and that's tough.
It is tough.
Yeah.
For someone like you, for whom life is so rich, to be not able to do what occurs to you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So what are the doctors saying?
Well, you know, at this point, I'm still continuing with the same mindset.
Yes, I know.
But
the mind is doing something the body may not be able to.
Really. You know, I have a patent. I have more than a dozen inventions. And I won't patent them because the patent system today is so corrupt. Oh. It doesn't do any good. It's
really
just a waste. Yeah. And I know it well because I went through the tough part. I went through getting my patent, which was on a kiln, getting my patent when there was no internet. And I was sitting in the Library of Congress with big patent books this big.
Trying to figure out how to do it.
Trying to look and make sure I would not find what I was looking for.
Oh, that it didn't exist.
Exactly.
Right.
So my whole life has been built on what's not there.
What's not there. And what you can see needs to be there.
Exactly.
It's amazing, Frank.
Yeah, my whole life has been thought that way.
Yes.
You know?
From the drawing of Mickey Mouse. Right? Right on up.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. You're an observer and a predictor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This has been so great. Thank you so much, Frank Olson.
Well, it's been real fun reviewing all this to you.
It's a wonderful life. It's a wonderful life, and we're looking forward to what you can predict and create from now on.
I am too. Yeah. Well, I don't have to look forward to it because I know it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, no, I'm looking forward to it. You just have to do it.
Exactly.
Thank you. Well, what more is there to say that Frank hasn't already said about being who you really are? of knowing from the minute that he could think that he was someone who would have an impact. He would have an impact on everyone he came in contact with, and he did everything that occurred to him. So if this interview has inspired you in any way, I hope that you will try to take seriously the fact that you may have left some of yourself behind, and that it is possible to live a life that is as connected as Frank Colson's is to himself. And next week, I'm airing my interview with his amazing wife, Diana Colson, another story of someone who is deeply and completely connected to who she is. So I hope you got something that you can use from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper, I may have gotten